A drop of cold water flicked his hot neck, and he jumped. Then another.
If I can pull George along, the rain will wash out our tracks.
Ronnie didn't let himself think how much harder it would be to pull the travois through mud. Instead, he yanked at the poles, straining, staggering uphill, away from the creek. Suddenly, it was easy. He lurched forward, almost jogging, then realized that must mean George had fallen off, or through, the vine webbing.
Oh!
It was too much. The pain in his head, the rain, the danger, the uncooperative vines. He had just found George's body when he saw the lights in the sky. A flitter, its searchlight directed into the forest.
Bloody hell!
He threw himself back, away from George. They had IR sensors, of course, and night vision goggles. They could see George. They could see him. He crouched, shaking from fear and exertion. Above the wind and thickening rain, he could just hear the flitter's drone. Its searchlight flicked among the trees, probing. But the canopy was thick here, near the stream, and the light never touched him. It did flick across George, and that garish belt pack he refused to bury. And it came back and centered there. The flitter sank into the canopy, its searchlight illuminating slanting lines of rain above and drips below.
They'll have a ladder, or a line, for dropping hunters directly into the forest. If I stay here...
He plunged away into darkness. Upslope, upstream, into the thicker forest and more broken country. If he could get rock between him and the IR scans, they couldn't see him. He picked his way from tree to tree in the dim radiance of the flitter's light. It would do no good to hurry. He must not fall and make a noise. He had a few seconds, perhaps, as someone came down the line from the flitter, someone who surely must be concentrating on a safe descent rather than a possible fugitive. Light brightened behind him. He dared a peek and saw a light source at head level. A helmet light, feebler than the flitter's searchlight, but perfectly adequate for close work. It lowered as if its bearer crouched. Over George, Ronnie was sure. He struggled against the desire to go back and protect his friend. Now two helmet lights glowed back there. He had to leave. He had to go now, while they did whatever they were doing to George. Because they must not catch all four of them. That was the only chance. But he had never imagined that he might have to leave a friend behind. He made himself move, one slow step after another, away from the lights.
I'm sorry, George. I'm sorry.
He made it, perhaps 50 meters.
Hey!
Reflex threw him forward into a wild, panicky run.
Over there!
Ronnie fell over another rock, banging both shins, and scrambled up. Too late for silence, for subtlety. Only speed would help him now. He tried to move faster through his memory of what the lightning revealed and fell again. He was in the creek, now only a meter wide. Rain lashed at him as he climbed, stumbled, climbed again. Ronnie struggled on, uphill, ignoring everything but the need to get away. His feet slipped on wet rocks, in mud. Rain beat his face, plastered his hair down, dragging at his shirt and trousers. Flash after flash of lightning revealed a grotesque landscape of wind-whipped foliage, ragged rocks, wind-tossed rain. He followed the creek, no longer worried about the poison in its water until he reached its source. Behind him, he could see flickering lights. The hunters, following what must be an obvious trail. He licked his lips, grateful for the pure rainwater that drenched him.
Where now?
The next flash of lightning showed him a narrow black cleft above and to his right. He clambered over the wet rocks, hoping it was deep enough to hide in, hoping it wasn't just a trick of lightning.
There he is!
Behind him, a stab of light. His shoulder burned. He plunged to the ground behind a rock and tried to see where the cleft had been. Lightning again. There, only a jump and a stretch. It still looked deep, a black gash in the rocky slope. He forced himself to stand, to take those few steps, to reach up and haul himself into darker darkness. When the next lightning came, he saw it as a blue-white flash against dark walls. Limping, staggering, he tried to work his way further in. Water trickled along between his feet, getting deeper. Pebbles rolled, and he lurched against the rocks, biting his tongue at the pain in his shoulder. Then the ground fell out from under his feet, and he slid down a crumbling slope into black oblivion. George awoke with a stiff neck and aching head. It was dark.
Night?
He tried to stretch and discovered that his wrists were bound behind his back.
Oh, this will never do.
He blinked several times and drew in a breath that stank of cleaning solution, old wood, and sour water. He felt around with his legs, glad to find that his captors had not tied his ankles. He could sit up, though he felt dizzy. The mind his father always doubted he had began to work. He couldn't remember how he'd gotten into this, but his friends never pulled tricks this unpleasant. He forced his mind back to the last clear memory, then tried to go forward. The flight to the island, the crash, Ronnie, pale and sick, the ragged islanders who claimed to be the victims of a manhunt. He and Ronnie building a trap of leaves and branches. A sound in the night. Dawn. Then nothing. He had not liked capture the first time, with Petrus and Oblo. This time, when he was sure it was their enemies, he liked it less. He had been captured somehow, that he could not yet remember, and he was confined in something that sounded and smelled like a closet for cleaning supplies. The others must still be free, or some of them, or he would be dead. He brushed that thought aside. He, George Starbridge Mahoney, was not going to die. That would not happen. Sordid deaths happen to others, not to young men of good family whose trousers never lost their crease. He was going to escape, and warn Lord Thornbuckle, and then go rescue Ronnie and the others. And the first thing to do was find out more about his prison. With difficulty, he levered himself up to his feet. It was remarkably hard to find his balance in the dark. He backed up slowly until his hands bumped a wall. His fingers recognized wood, then something papery, then more wood. He edged along, feeling for a corner, and bumped into a shelf that caught him painfully above the elbows. He felt a small bump against his back as a bottle on the shelf fell over and rolled. It occurred to him then that he should not let that object fall off the shelf. It would make noise, and noise might bring his captors, and his captors might think he knew where the others were hiding. His captors might even be unpleasant. He had not enjoyed the classes on interrogation resistance, which even the royals found necessary. He wanted nothing to do with the real thing. He leaned a little on the shelf, trying to encourage the small item to roll backwards. And the entire shelf fell off its supports. Fumes rose and stung his nose. His eyes burned. Tears rolled down his face. Light stabbed his eyes, and he lunged toward it. But the shadowy figures there shoved him back so hard that he could not keep his feet. He fell against the bucket and sat down hard in a puddle of whatever it was with the strong smell. He could feel it oozing through his expensive Gilsanmi trousers.
Oh, damn it!
Shut up or you'll get another dose.
Another dose. That meant he'd been drugged or poisoned. He had a tiny, shrinking vision of a creek, of a full water flask coming to his lips. With that memory came thirst, worse even than his headache.
I'm thirsty.
The unpleasant laugh reminded George of the senior bully the year he'd started school.
Too bad, but not for long.
No, wait. If they autopsy, they'll look for dehydration.
George tried to squint past the lights aimed at him, but still could not see either figure, or if there were more than two.
So, seawater might do that.
Nah, the old man said take care of them until we got the whole bunch.
He didn't say tell them the whole plan.
George glanced around the closet. In the light of its single fixture, it was as cramped and unpleasant as his experience in the dark suggested. It was about 2 by 3 meters, with the door in the middle of one long side, and shelves on either side of the door. Above the shelf he'd broken, 2 more supported a collection of brushes, cans, and jugs. On the other side of the door, the shelves held bathroom supplies in neatly labeled boxes. Behind him, mops and brooms hung from a rack. He had been lucky not to dislodge any of them when he fell over the mop bucket. It had to be a large house or building, probably on the neighboring island. Bandon, its name was. Bandon, where the landing field had signaled that they were unwelcome. Where the hunters, according to Petrus, were living in comfort in the lodge, while the victims struggled to survive on the island. George shook his head at the state of his trousers, which the bright light revealed to have suffered from the island even before the noxious green liquid that still filled his nose with stinging vapor. Never in his life had he been this disheveled. He noticed a rip in one sleeve and a long, greasy stain, as if he'd been thrown in a dirty cargo compartment for the trip here. He probably had. And without the use of his hands, he could not even tidy himself up. But he could get out of the puddle of smelly green stuff, which he was sure would do his trousers more harm than simple grime. For all he knew, it would eat its way through his skin as well. He braced his back against the wall of mops and stood. There. He could just grasp the handle of a mop. There ought to be some way of using it as a weapon the next time those persons opened the door, but he couldn't think of one.
You weren't supposed to get up.
With the 2 spotlights trained on his face, he still could see nothing of the men holding them.
I couldn't breathe. That stuff chokes me.
I wouldn't worry about that. But you said you were thirsty. Come on, then.
Was it safe to go out? It wasn't safe to stay here, he knew that much. He tried to step forward with assurance, as if he weren't even worried, but the green liquid was slippery as oil. He staggered and fell into the doorframe. Ungentle hands caught him under the armpits.
You're a regular comedy act, aren't you?
Thick cloth muffled his head, blinding him, and he felt hands, large, strong, and gloved, he thought, yank him along. He tried to judge what sort of space they were in, how far they'd come. A corridor, he thought, but he could not judge distance, not with the hard hands shoving him this way and that, breaking his concentration with slams against the wall or yanks on his bound arms. Finally, he heard a door open, a swing door, he thought, and a final shove sent him forward through it, just as the cloth was pulled away from his face. He staggered and fell onto a hard, cold floor in the dark. For a time, he lay there, nursing his new bruises, and wondering what to do now. But thirst drove him to explore. This smelled different, cleaner, colder, like a bathroom, he decided. He got to his knees and considered shuffling around like that, but the hard floor hurt his knees after only a few awkward moves, and he realized he would have to stand up again. This exploration, however, ended in success. He found the door through which he'd been shoved, and beside it the predictable panel of switches to control light and ventilation. Cool white light showed him a bathroom, certainly a staff facility, for it had none of the amenities the family rooms would have had. A row of sinks set into a counter with mirrors above, he winced away from his image, and a row of plumbing fixtures. The stack of clean glasses on the counter mocked him.
How am I supposed to turn the water on? Or get it in the glass?
That struggle occupied him some time. The sinks had water-saving faucets, so that they would not run long without a finger on the control, and the control was mounted at a convenient height for someone with free hands.
Oh.
George had to hitch himself up onto a sink, almost sitting in it, to reach the control. He was sure the entire counter and sinks arrangement was going to fall off the wall and cause a flood. He could turn the water on, but he could not drink, not while facing away from the sink. And the sinks had no plugs, so he could not fill one and drink from it. Finally, he realized that he would have to take a glass from the stack and position it in a sink, all out of his sight, and then climb up to start the water and hope the glass was in the right position. Then take the glass out of the sink and set it on the counter, close enough to the edge that he could tip it with his mouth and finally drink. It took a very long time. He broke two glasses, cut his fingers, and almost decided that thirst was better than this struggle. But his stubbornness forced him on, and the lukewarm water, the half glass of it he managed to drink before the glass tipped over and spilled the rest down his chin and neck, tasted amazingly good. He could almost feel his brain cells soaking it up and going back to work. Now he could think of what to do. Now he would get back to his own script for this miserable outing and come out as he always did, clean, pressed, and in control. It was not so bad being locked in a bathroom. Basic bodily functions accounted for. He stopped halfway to the fixture he had planned to use and realized another problem. How was he supposed to open his trousers with his hands tied behind him? It wouldn't do any good to yank on the waistband from behind, not with these. They were designed to withstand incredible force. He would think about it later. It was not that big a problem. Yet. On the other hand, he would make do with that one half glass of water and not waste energy trying to get another.